Hey everyone, welcome to You're Not Crazy, Psychology in Real Life. Today we have a treat for you. We had the opportunity to interview an author who has written books about abuse and mental health issues. We had a wonderful time. Her name is Kate Russell, and she has written two books. The first one is Down the Rabbit Hole, a memoir of abuse, addiction, and recovery. And the book is about her childhood and surviving abuse, her parents' addictions, and her own addiction and recovery. I highly recommend it. It was a great book. The second book that she wrote is called Voicemails from My Sister, Stories of a Schizoaffective Sibling. And that book also was excellent. It is specifically about her sister who is diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder and the struggles and hardships and joys of growing up as an older sister to a sister with mental health issues. Malachi and I really enjoyed meeting her and our discussion. We hope even to have her back at some point, and she plans to continue writing books. So I hope you enjoy our interview today. And if you're interested in learning more about Kate, you can go to her website, which is katerussellauthor.com.
Welcome to You're Not Crazy, Psychology in Real Life with Dr. Kim Champion and host Malachi Champion, where we discuss how we are all more okay than we sometimes think or feel. Join us on a journey where we explore psychological concepts and apply them to our everyday lives.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of You're Not Crazy, Psychology in Real Life with Dr. Kim Champion.
Hello.
And me, Malachi, her son. Hope everybody's doing well today. We have a special guest with us today. Her name is Kate Russell. She has written a couple books about mental health or the lack thereof and coping with all of the stuff that goes on around the difficulties. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're excited to have you. We have a couple questions we want to discuss. Some of the things she wrote about, and we hope we get you interested in reading if it sounds like something that'll be helpful to you. But first, how are you today, Kate?
I'm doing well. I woke up not too long ago, and it's 70 and sunny, so
nice.
It's gonna be a beautiful day.
I think it's actually pretty warm here. It's certainly warm in my office. We don't have an AC set up yet, but yeah, I have 86 and sunny in northern Vermont.
Whoa.
86?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
What is happening?
And humid,
upstairs,
I bet.
Office, yeah. Covered up window, computer running.
Ooh.
It's great.
Yeah, it's 70 here too, but cloudy and humid, so.
Not humid.
I here. Opened windows, but I don't know that. I may be running in the middle of this podcast to close them if rain comes. It looks like rain might come, so.
I hope so, for your sake. Kill that humidity. Speaking of your sake, how are you today, Mom?
I'm well, thank you.
That's good.
I'm also excited to be doing our first interview. Excited that I've gotten the chance to meet Kate and learn a lot in the process. Happy that the warm weather's coming. I'm so hyper-focused on that because that makes me always feel so much better.
Well, we talked last week about how the longer days and the higher temperatures are mood-boosting all on their own. So,
yeah,
makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's so true. I have seasonal depression or whatever. Like daylight savings time, forget it.
In the fall, when we lose that hour, it is absolutely demoralizing for me. Yeah.
It's so
sad. I love being jet lagged at home.
It's so sad. I get so sad. It's like, bye, son. It's 4:30. Have a good night.
Yep. I'll see you in 12 hours.
Yeah.
More.
So much more energy when there's sun. So, yeah. How about you, Malachi? How you doing?
Good. Like I said, it's been hot here, which I'm not crazy. I moved here because I like the cold, but
because you're weird.
This
week,
that's strange.
And it wasn't too hot. Even still, when I fell into the mud, it was very refreshing.
Oh no.
On purpose?
Didn't get back to any of your updates.
That was like a slip, kind of. I caught myself. I'm being dramatic for the sake of the podcast. But it's nice. They have the AC on at the restaurant where I work, which is a lifesaver. Yeah, leaves are all coming in. I think I'm almost to the end of the period where my allergies are the worst. It's good. It's all looking up.
Cool.
All so right.
Let's crack in. Mom, where did you want to start? You well, were the more prepared one here.
Wait, did you say prepared?
You're the more prepared one.
Yeah, that's the story of our lives. And I'm always maybe by like the skin of my teeth because, you know.
This is where I mentioned that more is a relative term.
Exactly. Okay, so I wanted to start simply just to get a feeling for what led you to start writing books about your life and your history.
Sure. Yeah. So, okay, so I have two books. So Down the Rabbit Hole, A Memoir of Abuse, Addiction, and Recovery. And then my second book is Voicemails from My Sister, Stories of a Schizoaffective Sibling. I am currently writing my third book, which is tentatively titled My Father, the Juggernaut. And then my last one will be something about my mother. So, yeah. So, and then I'll package that as a series and sell it as a Portrait of a Dysfunctional Family. Yay!
Love it.
Hurrah! Like, happy topics. But,
Sounds great.
I know, right?
And something everybody can relate to, for
Agreed.
Sure.
Agreed. We all have a dysfunctional family,
on one
right?
level.
Yeah. In some way, right? There's some dysfunction. There just is. We're people. So... But when I was – so what led me to start writing in the first place, I was a little girl and I knew I was going to write a book. Down the Rabbit Hole is basically my memoir. And I had a crappy childhood, you know? Shocking, right? Didn't we all sort of – or maybe not. I don't know. But, you know –
Well, I'm on a call with my mom.
You're not allowed to say you did, but I get – I know you did. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. But so I was – you know, I had – My parents were drug addicts, alcoholics. I was abused. I was neglected. I had to be my mother's sister because she, you know, when she was born, my mother was literally like always napping off a hangover or drunk. My dad was not there because he was a workaholic. So he was never there. I had to be my mother's sister. It was bad. And so I was like, oh,
wait. I'm going to stop you. You mean your sister's mother,
yeah,
right?
Had to do that.
Because you were saying my mother's sister.
Oh, how funny.
You could have been both.
Oh, how funny. Did I say my mother's sister?
Both times.
Mm-hmm. I'm drunk. Just kidding. I had to be my sister's mother.
That would be a twist.
That's so funny. Right? I had to be my sister's mother.
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt your
No,
quote.
I'm so glad you clarified that.
I was going to say, did I misunderstand the book?
People would be so confused. Yeah, did you not get that? Did I not say that?
Right. Well, I guess I had the names wrong.
That's so funny. Yeah. So when I was little, I knew I was like, I'm going to write a book one day. That's just all there is to it. Because when I was young and being abused and all this stuff, I knew I wasn't alone. If I was going through this, mm-hmm. so were other people. And people were going to have their own versions of exactly my story, but their own experiences. And I just was like, I know I'm not alone. And I don't know that everybody knows they're not alone. And I need to share the story so that people know they're not
and
alone.
And that's definitely one of the things that makes you and your books so special is that not everybody who is in that dark place has that sense of the world around them. You know, not everybody who's there doesn't feel alone.
Right. Agreed. Agreed. I talk about the God voice a lot in my in Down the Rabbit Hole. And I had this strong sense. I do not know where this came from, but I had this strong sense of being taken care of and of God.
That's beautiful.
From a very young age. It just was innate. It was just in me because we did not have religion. We did not go to church or anything. But my grandmother, when I would sleep over her house, we would pray at night and we would just say the Lord's Prayer. And that was it. That was my only like relationship or introduction to God. But I had a strong sense that everything was going to be okay and that this chaos was temporary and was a learning experience. And I also knew that not everybody has that being young because I did grow up in kind of a lower middle class school system and town, and so a lot of people came from dysfunctional families, and we would get told in school and often that if your parents are using drugs, you know, DARE was big. You know, yeah. DARE was big.
Yeah.
You need to know it's not your fault. We were told that a lot. We had, like, police officers come in and do DARE things, and we were told a lot. So not only by, like, police officers, but, like guidance counselors and teachers, that, like, if your parents are using drugs or drinking, it's not your fault. I never thought it was my fault, and I never...
Why are you telling me this so much? I was not worried about
but
it, but now I am.
But I saw that other people very much, like, blamed themselves and, like, my parents drink because I'm bad, kind of. Like, I saw that was, like, in other people, and, you know, I started writing because I was, like, people obviously feel alone. They need to know they're not alone, and I think that this power of positive thinking is within us, and you can call that the God voice or just positive thinking, whatever you want, but, like, it's accessible if we look for it and tap into it.
Yeah, which is amazing. Malachi and I have both acknowledged on this podcast before that we are both optimists, and that we tend to see the good in things. And I can hear that a lot in what you're saying. You know, even as a kid, there was some redemption, like some redeeming value that you could grab onto that you might not experience till later, but had reassurance was going to be there. And that is truly amazing.
Mm. Yeah.
To be able to hold on to the silver lining thing is, well, it's like a superpower.
Mm. Yeah, I just, I knew I was going to write a book. I felt like a writer when I was a little kid. I was like, I'm going to write this. This is a book. This is what's happening is a book.
It took me a long time to start feeling like a writer.
Oh, really?
Just as a point of interest, yeah. I thought I was going to be good at all sorts of other things because I had so many interests and stuff. But, like, you know, sports and visual art and things, I didn't have the coordination to do any of it. I couldn't make it happen like how I could visualize it. And I really, for me, it was discovering that if I just described the painting I wanted to make, that went well.
Yeah. 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 When I sat down to write Rabbit Hole, it poured out of me. Again, I felt like I felt like God was writing the book through me. It was
amazing.
Easy. Because
it's a good feeling.
Yes. It's a great feeling. I never had writer's block or anything like that. I never got stuck or didn't know what to do next or write next or where to go next, you know. And I just, you know, and I've kind of felt like that with voicemails. Voicemails I tried to structure a little bit more. And I think I'm going to go back to telling, because a memoir, I think, is best told in short stories that paint a larger picture. And that's how I'm going to do My Father the Juggernaut. It's going to be, again, like Rabbit Hole is short stories that I think paint a bigger picture. And then so is voicemails to some degree, but I think I tried to go a little more chronological and get a little more, talk a little bit more about, like, actual mental illness and facts.
And definitely feels like a book about Sibby's developing brain.
Yeah.
You know, it really, she's set on a weird course early in childhood. And then it's the whole book kind of feels like trying to steer her back toward a course that just won't take.
Yeah.
And so I totally see what you mean by focusing on the chronology of it. And I think it makes for a compelling narrative to watch, just as you work to help and to be available and to make a difference, and the varying degrees to which you help and make a difference is, you know, what the book's about. So,
yeah,
like I said, makes for a very compelling thing.
Thank you. Yeah.
So one of the things that I found really, like, I was very interested in voicemails that I think would be really helpful for our listeners is you talk about a little bit about your process of figuring out that you needed to check in with yourself before you took her calls, you know, figuring out that you needed to set some boundaries. And I was wondering a little bit about that process, like what that looked like for you in real terms.
Yeah, well, so Sibby was eventually diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, which is a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So she has paranoid delusions as well as mania. Now,
the hell of a combination.
Yes.
Absolutely horrible.
And hard to deal with.
Yeah.
So I do have to ask myself when my phone rings, can I mentally handle what could possibly be on the other end of the line? Because at least 50% of the time, it's mania. And it's going to be peppered with a lot of untrue things that she thinks are happening. And then 50% of the time, or maybe 40% of the time, it's a normal, you know, normal time. You know, it's, hey, how are you? You know, just wanted to tell you about this. There's always some mania, but you know, it's a little more manageable. Yeah, I mean, it's still that way. She has been on every cocktail of medications for mood stabilizers, antidepressants, as well as anticonvulsants. She had epilepsy. Yeah, she had epilepsy when she was a little kid. She also had Lyme disease. She was diagnosed with ADD when she was young, but that was, so, you know, there's some of that. So she's been on all these different meds, and really nothing has ever been solved this problem of the paranoid delusions and the mania. Sometimes some things help with one thing, but not with the other. Right now, she has been off medication for over a year. And now guess what though? Her paranoid delusions are greatly eliminated. So that makes me question if the medications that are supposed to solve the problem actually exacerbate the problem. Now, she still has some. She still has some paranoid delusions, but it's much less. Where it used to be 50% of the things out of her mouth are untrue, but she thinks they're true. Now I would say it's maybe 20%. Yeah, which is like amazing.
But that's a huge difference.
That is.
Yes. So, yeah. But she's very sped up. So the mania is there. Yeah. But, I mean, it's you learn to deal with whatever circumstances you're in, you know? And so I'm used to her mania. And so I do automatically know, oh, can't take that call right now, can't handle it. Or, you know what I mean? It just, again, just like an innate reaction. I'm not going to answer the phone right now. Or, I'm in an okay place. Hey, what's up, Sibby? You know?
Right. And that was the lesson. At some point, you probably, you know, I guess I'm asking you, at some point, did you say to yourself, wait, just because she calls doesn't mean I have to answer? Or if I don't answer, it doesn't have to be because I'm like, I'm not answering. At some point, you must have learned that.
She has a bad habit of calling like 100 times in a row.
Nice.
Yeah. She's one of those, you know, but it's part of her disease, you know? She'll, and that's how I know not to answer.
Right.
Because, oh, that's
it's
crazy happening. Yeah. I often don't answer the phone, period, in my life. You know, I'll look at it and be like, I can't, I'll call him back in 5 minutes, you know? Because we're busy people and, you know, are like, I'm at work, I can't answer the phone. Or like, I'll look at it and be like, you know, if depending on who it is, I'll just go, I'll call him back in 5 minutes, or that can go to voicemail or whatever. Well, if she feels like you're ignoring her call and she's in a state of mania, she will call repeatedly, and she'll like, and sometimes sometimes she'll leave a voicemail and it'll be chaos and angry and defensive, you know, like, so I guess see you're avoiding my call and well, I just thought you should know that I'm dying and you know, and it's crazy. And sometimes she won't leave a message, and then I'll be like, well, you know, and then when I do call her back, she's like, oh, it'll be something like, or it has been something like, well, you should have answered the phone. I was, you know, there was something very important I had to tell you, but now I forgot. And I'm like, well, you should have left it.
Yeah.
Well, you should have left a message. You know, I don't leave messages because she's paranoid that somebody's listening to her messages. And I'm like, okay.
Oh.
So.
I guess texts probably aren't safe then either.
No, texts are actually have proven to be good with her, because when she has to put things, she actually is also just a naturally kind of gifted writer. When she has to put things into sentences, she does so clearly. So
I've always said it really helps to have it in front of you so that you can work with it.
Yeah. I'm like, one of the best things to me about probably writing. A better way to communicate. Yeah.
Neat.
Yeah. That is interesting.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things in voicemails is your when you relate some of the phone calls, you put in there what your brain thinks and then what you actually say.
Yes.
And those are some of the funniest parts of the book because and I can so identify with the thought process because you get exhausted after a while kind of dealing with the same things over and over.
Yeah.
And every time you're making decisions about, oh, do I continue with this? Mm-hmm. Do I set a limit? What do I do here?
Yeah. I had to ask her, or what she was diagnosed as schizoaffective in her early 20s, which is pretty typical time to be diagnosed with that.
Yeah.
And for a few years there, I thought she was just a liar. And I remember telling her caseworker at the time, I can't talk to her. She just lies. She just lies all the time. And she said, no, she honestly believes the things that she's telling you. That's what schizoaffective disorder is. It's delusions, but she believes they're true. And I was like, what? I've never heard of such a thing. What do you mean?
Right.
And I was like, well, I don't know how to react to that. Because I'm not going to encourage it. I'm not going to say, you wrote a song for Britney Spears? Tell me more. Why didn't you want the fame? And why, that's so humble of you to not want financial reward for something so profitable. And no, I'm not going to do that. You know,
right.
I'm not playing along. Right. That's not happening. This is not Lars and the Real Girl. No, we're not pretending your fake girlfriend is real. No, you know what I mean? But,
forgot about that.
Such a good movie.
Lars,
right?
The Real Girl.
Yeah, not happening. good movie, not happening in real life. So that's why I had to just be like, well, that I just, if I can't. So what I do and what I started doing is just when it goes off the rails, I have to go. You know, all right, I gotta go.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta go. I love you. I'll talk to you later. You know.
good luck with that.
Yeah.
Bye.
I just don't even. They're like, I just go. All right, I gotta go. And it depending on where her mood is, sometimes she's like, okay, well, I'll call you back later. Or like, okay. And sometimes she gets defensive. And then, you know, and sometimes I've gotten frustrated that she's gotten defensive. And been like, you're going crazy right now. I'm not doing it. You know, I'm not getting on this ride. Mm-mm. You know?
Right. And you do have to protect yourself as much as you love her. And it's very clear in both books how much you love your sister.
That's good.
How much compassion you have for her. Like from the instant she was born, which, you know, I think is a beautiful thing.
Well, you wouldn't still describe yourself as being in a having to mother your sister situation if you didn't care.
I really liked it, actually. I mean, but this was me, you know, that's me, like, making the best out of, like, a crappy situation, you know? But I liked being her mother when I was little. I was 5 when she was born, and I was immediately thrust into the role of mother. But I was good at it because I was also her. I was little, so I could get into the crib with her, like the playpen with her. I could, you know, I could, but I could also change a diaper and heat up formula on the stove and feed her baby food and give her a bath, you know, like, and I could get in the bath with her and, you know, like, and I was like, oh, I like this. I was playing house, you know?
Right.
Except that, like, there really was a real person here whose life kind of did depend on me because my mother was sleeping.
which is so much pressure, you know, like, there were good things about it, and you can see right now the good that came out of it for you and for her, but also that is really destructive for a child to have to carry that weight.
Yeah, and my Nana used to acknowledge that, you know, my mother's mother. She'd be like, you know, it's not fair that you have to mother your sister, and I'm sorry that you do. She did all she could do, but she didn't live in the same town. And my parents, my mother cut her out of our life for a long time. My gamma, my dad's mother, used to sneak us to go see them if, you know, or phone calls and birthday cards would get sent there. But my mother cut her mother out of our lives because her mother told her she was an alcoholic and needed help. And
well, we can't have that.
No, you can't be called out on your shit. Sorry, is this a French-speaking podcast? You can't be called out.
Okay.
We know words and phrases, but I wouldn't exactly call us conversational in French here.
Yeah, so, but it is what it is. I mean, I never ever wanted, I was always on a quest to be happy. I am still on a quest to be happy. I don't want to see things in the negative, you know? So, yeah, like, I didn't want to be, you know, it's just like, it's okay, Nana, you know? No, I mean, I like it. I liked, and I had to remain her mother for a long time. So, like, when she became school age and it was like, make your sister's lunch, make your sister's dinner, you know, get your sister up in the morning. I was making the best. Yeah. I was like, I like it. I get her up. I get to choose her outfit, you know? I get to do her hair. I get to cut the crust off of her peanut butter and jelly and cut it into four box pieces like she likes it. I get to put a little note in her lunchbox saying I love you, like I wish my mother
that
had
was
done.
So you know? Touching when I saw that. Yeah. I think know? I did that for my kids like twice ever.
Each. Don't sell yourself short. It was twice each.
Twice each. All right. Thanks. It wasn't even me who made your lunches. It was your father, but.
Yeah, so why were you putting notes in them?
Well, because his love language is acts of service, so he did that, and mine is words.
There you go. See? I like that.
It all worked together. Yeah, so that makes sense. And it's interesting, too, because as much as you love her, also that, oh, I do want to say your quest to see the good and to stay happy. I love that. That is a superpower that you have for sure. Yeah, not everyone has that. And some people learn it. They have to learn it. And some people sometimes have to like pull it in, like in their healing process, they have to pull it in from the strength of others and then have it, which all the ways are legitimate. But
are you saying that some people are born optimists, some people become optimists, and some have optimism thrust upon them?
Yes, I'm kind of saying that.
I was like, yes, well put, Dr. Seuss.
Thank you.
I know. Let's write that down.
I liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and indeed, and I think it's God-given. I mean, I just think it was in me, so it's God-given.
I agree.
Yeah.
That it was a supernatural superpower. Mm-hmm. You know, you got it from outside of yourself and inside of yourself. It's kind of all...
Well, I think God is within us, so there you go. It is both outside and within, yes.
We just covered all of it. Yeah. But another thing, so my sister has special needs, and she's 5 years younger than me.
Oh, look at that. We have so much in common.
I know. We do. My sister, and I did get permission from her to share this.
Good.
She has autism spectrum disorder. Mm. We built an addition onto our house because someday when my parents are not alive, she'll need a place to live. And, you know, she functions well in many ways, but... to take care of herself fully on her own, unfortunately, autism and anxiety have robbed her of some of those skills. Mm-hmm. But one of the lines that you have in here, which, and I love my sister to death. I also took care of her. I mothered her. I my dates often included her, my 5 year younger sibling. My husband and I joke about that sometimes, you know, went to 4th of July together with our blanket, and it was Chris, me, and my sister,
That's sweet.
And of course, as a teenager, I resented that sometimes and bucked against it some.
Of course.
But you have a line in here where you say, where you kind of yelled at her about something, and your line is, she remained the one person who could make me livid. Mm. And I just wrote me next to it because in my office, you can say or do anything you want. You can speak any way you want. You have tons of freedom, and I'm not going to judge you. I love people and I love their stories, and I want people to feel safe and free and just do your thing. And I've worked with many people with autism spectrum disorder, in addition to lots of other stuff, and totally could feel compassion even when they were being objectively annoying, because, you know, that's kind of how that is sometimes. And I can be objectively annoying. So just in the interest of full disclosure,
no.
But my right? No, thank you for lying. Anyway, But my sister, she could annoy me with like a breath, Like, you know, she didn't even have to say a word. And I love her to death.
Walk in and say hello. And you're like, ah.
I know.
So I can relate to that. I think the people we love the most also can, you know, make us the craziest, really.
Absolutely. For me, absolutely, familiarity breeds resentment. And guess what? I'm working on that.
We're always working on that. Works in progress.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I'm in a way, way better place on that. Probably, well into adulthood, I struggled. I mean, my kids were around and saw it. And I used to just question myself, like, what is wrong with you? Like, you can deal with everybody's stuff except your sister.
Yeah, it's it trickles down from, for me, my dad. My dad is the same way. Like, he's real nice to people he doesn't know very well, but he's just anything can make him snap when it came to me and my sister or my mom, you know. I think it's common.
There is. Yeah, there's human nature in that. Yeah. But, you know, between talking about it and my own therapy and talking to God about it, I have definitely, I'm in a whole different place. Like, I do so much better.
Good.
So, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I have one other question that I'm very curious about the answer for.
Yeah.
The answer to. For you, where do you draw the line between sickness and I mean with your parents, also, Sibby, maybe especially with your parents, but where do you draw the line between sickness and their responsibility?
Oh, boy, that is a good question. Oh, man. Well, look, you know, parenting is such a huge decision, responsibility, and I believe when you have a child, you are taking on that responsibility. So you have decided, a la Uma Thurman in Kill Bill 2, I have a lot of movie references, that you are going to change your life for this decision that you have made. Your life is not about you anymore. You've decided by conceiving and deciding to have the child that you're going to live for you're putting them first now. They come first now. So you got to do whatever that takes, right? Now, if you have an illness like addiction, that means now you take care of that.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to have such high standards, but this is what I would do, you know? with my parents, they did the opposite of that. They very much made the choice that, like, I mean, all we have to do is get this baby out and then it's on its own, basically. We don't have to, you know, we just have to birth it because, you know, we can't abort. My mother had already had two abortions by the time she was pregnant with me. And my dad is not, he's kind of anti-abortion. He thinks it's only, you should only abort if it like endangers the life of the mother or if something's gravely wrong with the baby. So he was like, we're having a baby. That's what's happening. But all we have to do is have the baby. We don't have to raise it.
Once you birth it, it's done, right?
That's yeah. The easy part. That's it.
The end of the hard part, rather.
So they're very ego-driven and selfish. My parents were and are. And so they were not willing to change their lifestyle at all. Thus the ingestion of drugs and alcohol during pregnancy and the continued drug abuse and physical abuse, et cetera, once we were born. So, you know, I don't really give the fact that my my father is an addict, quote unquote, alcoholic, quote unquote, because he kind of just quits things cold turkey. And so I don't really know. He's a workaholic. He's a rageaholic. But is he a drug addict? I don't know. My mother was. But take care of it then. You know, you have a choice to take care of that. You have, you know, and now you have kids. So you have a responsibility to take care of that. But she was like, you know, she was being coached by my father, who was like, just that's fine. Just go ahead and drink while you're pregnant. All we have to do is birth this child. All we have to do is get it out, you know, like so. if you're being encouraged by your partner to do the thing that you love to do, you know, you're probably going to be like, oh, okay, it's just all this justifying, right? You know, like, oh, I don't absolutely have to get healthy. I don't have to take care. She might have felt that she should have at some point, but he never thought that he doesn't even think that addiction is a real thing. He thinks he said it to me. Addiction's not a disease. It's a choice. You make the choice to pick up that drink. You're right. You're right. You do make the choice to pick up that drink, but that's not what addiction is. Addiction is a brain disorder, you know? And so you have to treat that. You can be an alcoholic and never had a drink in your life. That's not what it is. It's a brain disorder. It's a problem with your thinking, with your decision making. So really putting down the drink is just the first step. And then you're going to deal with a lot of other stuff that's going to start coming up and you'll see it. But anyway, you can't be drunk and on drugs every day of your life when you have children. So I don't really give them too much of a pass, you know. At the same time, I'm not holding a grudge about it. I don't, everything makes you stronger, right? Yeah, I don't think things happen by accident. I do think that all of these experiences that I had were opportunities for spiritual growth, and I use them as such and continue to. So,
nice.
Yeah. Amazingly well put. I agree wholeheartedly with everything that you said there, because sometimes clients that I work with who have been in similar situations either feel like they can't express the extent of their hurt or their or what they've gone through, which I agree with you. I think you need to be honest with your feelings and express those things, but that isn't where you want to live.
Yeah.
So in my office, that's what we're doing. We're trying to call it what it is and put it out there and connect dots and take away self-blame, because honestly, most people do put these things on themselves.
Yeah.
Because as kids, it's hard not to, but a lot of times clients will struggle in their healing process because they will feel guilty for being mad at their parents because they were sick. And I think it's a balance of, yeah, they were sick. You can acknowledge that. Also, they made choices, and they could have, like, look at you. You're in my office getting help. Mm-hmm. You're in my office working to heal so that you don't repeat the same mistakes, or so that you don't, you know, have your own ways that you are blind to how you're affecting other people. Mm-hmm. And they could have done that too. They could have made choices that were different also. Amen. Like you said, you're if you have an addiction and you have a child, take care of it.
Yeah. I mean, what are you doing? I believe that we are all on a spiritual journey. We are here to grow our souls. This is what I believe. It's just, again, innate, maybe God-given in me, that we are, that's the point of us being here, right? That to grow our souls, to better prepare our souls for the next life, and then it's so that our soul is constantly growing, right? Because you hear, like, old soul, then you see young soul, right? And it's like, oh, you're baby soul. You got a lot of lives to live in order to learn a lot of lessons in order to graduate your soul or get it moved on or whatever, to grow it. And so the way that we look at things that happen to us, I think, has a lot to do with, are we growing our soul or are we setting it back? Because we're making choices, you know? So what are you doing, Mom? You know, you're setting your soul back. You're not even hurting me. You're hurting your soul. You're hurting the next life that this soul is going to, you know, take on.
And right.
You're going to learn this lesson eventually. Your soul is going to learn the lessons in this life or the next, you know?
Might as well get it over with then.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yes.
And our own personal forgiveness for how, you know, you can forgive people who never ask for forgiveness or take responsibility, because that's good for your soul.
Exactly. Totally.
That
frees
you up.
I'm not mad at my dad. I mean, I love my dad. I don't have anger. I feel for his soul. You know, I do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is there any, like, frustration or disappointment about what happened? Like, because I really love not being angry at the person.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you balance not being angry at the person with being realistic about what happened?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I do always just try to look at things from the perspective of look where I am mm-hmm. now.
Look at me now.
Yeah. And like what could, look at where I could be. Like look where I came from and now look where I am now, right? And when I look at it with that perspective, I'm like, that's impressive. I'm excited about that. That makes me happy and proud. And so that's good. When I look at my circumstances or whatever, my childhood, and then I look at other people and where they are now, that'll make me look back at my childhood with regret. If I go, well, I'd be where they are now if I had had this, that, and the other thing as a child. If my parents had put me first, if they had allowed me to, you know, continue in I took a voice class for like 15 minutes and a dance class for like 5 minutes before my parents were constantly taking me up. They'd be like, yeah, you can take a dance class. Oh, wait, I have to drive you. Never mind. Oh, you get it. You know, oh, well, look, I'd be
I have responsibility about
this. Yeah. Never mind. You can't have it then, you know? So it's easy. It would be easy to look back and be bitter and angry because I'll look at people, you know, oh, look at that amazing dancer. If I had been allowed to continue in dance, I could be an amazing dancer, you know, this kind of thing. Well, I can't do that. I can't live there, you know?
Right.
Also, that person who's an amazing dancer, first of all, I've been taught, you know, and I think this is really good, don't compare your insides to other people's outsides. You have no idea what that beautiful dancer has gone through.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, you have no idea, you know? Like, she also could have, like, some stuff, you know? But also, I traveled a great distance from where I was, you know, and I have no idea how far others have traveled. And I can only look at my journey and go, I'm proud of that journey, you know.
It's like, I've heard life called an individual sport. Mm-hmm. Like track, sure, there are other people on the racetrack mm-hmm. and somebody's got to have the fastest time for that heat. But the real competition in a sport like that is you beating your previous time.
Yes, your only competition is you, you know? So when I look at it like that, it's easy to have a very positive attitude about it because I go, no, I came up. Now, if I had remained in my own addiction and kind of gone down that rabbit hole, which I easily could have and was and could still, you know, for sure. They say, you know, a drink is only this far away kind of thing, you know, like I can turn around and undo a lot of what I've done, you know, but I don't really want, I'm not trying to go out that way, you know, I don't want to go out that way.
Awesome.
You know, mm-hmm. I'd rather just, they say, I mean, I've been sober now almost 11 years and they say like, it's,
wow,
in a row.
Well done.
Thank you.
In a row.
that is an important detail, isn't it?
And they say, like, it's easier to stay sober than it would be to get sober. And I think, like, that's not just about sobriety, but it's easier to go through whatever you're going through than it would be to, like, set it back and you're going to have to go through it eventually, right? So don't set this anger back by delaying it, by drinking about it or using about it or, you know, throwing a punch about it or writing an angry Yelp review about it or like, just go through the anger, just have the anger, have the feeling and move upwards. Don't move downwards. Don't move backwards. You know, like we have to kind of keep that. I have to keep that mindset, you know? Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. You're only competing against yourself. Yeah. You know?
Say that again?
Yeah. You're only competing against yourself. Like, again, I can't be looking at that person because the way that person's handling it could be very dysfunctional and justify my own reaction. Like, well, they're lashing out. Well, they're having a drink. Well, they're, you know, bitching about it. You know, like, why can't I? Right. Well, you know, because you're on a different journey. Just don't.
Right. Right.
Don't do what that person's doing. Do what's better for you. Ultimately.
Do what's better. Yeah.
Be better.
I have to make a movie reference here because you said in one of the podcast interviews I was listening to, you said one of your guiding principles is just making the next right move or taking the next right step.
And Malachi
named the movie Frozen 2.
Frozen 2, I've not seen.
One of the motifs in that film is you have to do the next right thing.
Oh, I love that. That's very AA. A writer of Frozen 2 is in AA. It's very AA.
I believe it.
Just take the next indicated action. Yeah. Yeah.
The other good one is Olaf says, we call this controlling what you can when your life feels out of control.
Oh my God, I think I have to go see Frozen 2.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's better than it has any business being, in my opinion.
It's really good. And Anna's the one, she sings a whole song about, because she's in an impossible circumstance, a seemingly impossible circumstance, and she sings a song about, well, I guess all I can do is take the next right step.
Yeah,
and
right.
I thought that was so, I had never heard it that way. It was so profound when I heard it. I was like, what? I love that.
Right. Yeah, just exactly. Like, so is it easier to just go through whatever it is I'm going through right now and get through it than it would be to take a step backwards? I'm still going to have to go through it eventually. Or I'm not going to grow. That's what I'm here for. You know?
Exactly. Exactly. Getting towards the end here, I want to bring up a happy encouragement about humanity story, which is a story you tell in voicemails about your poor sister having a panic attack on the way up to a water ride, water slide.
Oh, I'm so glad you're going to talk about this. It was so beautiful what happened. Okay, go on.
I loved it. Yeah. So do you want to just tell that story kind of briefly for the listeners? And
oh, yeah. Yeah. So we were at a Raging Waters water park, and we were going to go on a water slide, and it had a rickety staircase, as they all do, made of wood, which they all are, that swayed in the wind and creaked, right? And so we started at the bottom. That's how long the line was. And then we slowly made our way up, step by step, all the way up to the top. Well, about midway up, Sibby, my sister, remembered that she was terrified of heights, and the swaying of the stairs caused her to have a panic attack, and she grasped onto both banisters, and she was just staring down. And this was it wasn't really out of nowhere, but it was like she had been okay. We had been it was me and her, and then two of my friends, a work friend and his brother, and they were just beautiful souls. These two guys are beautiful souls. And they, we had all been just talking, and they were cool. Like before we even got there, I was like, my sister has schizoaffective disorder. She's a little weird, but like, you know, she's coming to visit. So,
also it can be sudden, but it's fine.
Also what?
It can be sudden.
Oh yeah, I didn't tell them that, but they were like super cool to her the whole time, right? They were like talking to her, engaging her, asking her about her life, and it was like cool because she's part of what her disease is like, social awkwardness too, and so being around my friends when she doesn't have a friend to balance it out is uncomfortable, you know. But I was like, well, we're going to Raging Waters, this will be fun, you'll like these guys, and she did, and I was like, cool. So she already had like a safety feeling with them. So we were on the stairs, and she has this panic attack, and she grasps onto both banisters, and she's staring down, and she's having a panic attack, like the breathing and the, and she's like, and I'm like, and I did not, I was embarrassed. You know, this was pre-sober Kate, you know, and this was still embarrassment and ego Kate. And I was like, come on, stop overreacting. And I tried to grab her arm to pull her up to the next step. And she, don't touch me, don't touch me, don't touch me. And she freaks out. And the two friends that we were with were like, yo, it's cool, Sibby. Don't worry. Don't worry. You don't want to move. You don't have to move. Not a problem. Like, it's okay. It's okay.
Nice.
And then very soon, one of the ride attendants, came down the stairs and had obviously dealt with this before, or was just another awesome, cool soul, and said, honey, it's okay. Do you want to come up to the top and sit with me? So, like, and she was like, yes. And he was like, okay, cool. Do you want to take one of my hands? And she's like, okay. And she, like, grasped onto his hand and like held onto the banister with the other hand. And he's like, yes, awesome, good. And then, so we were in a line of people, and then people behind us started going, you got this, it's cool, good, good, and started encouraging her. And she, awesome. And that gave her the courage and strength to then grasp onto his hand with her other hand, and he led her up steps, and everybody just started like applauding and, yay, you got this, good for you, girl. And she like made it to the top because of all these people supporting her, like literally applauding and telling her, you got this, go girl, it's cool, we got you, you're safe. And she went to the top, and she sat at the top with him, and then until we got to the top, and we went down the slide together, and she was cool. They gave her a soda. She sat there and she was just like sitting at the top, because I think she felt like, I think it was the slow descent up that made her super nervous. But when she got to the top and she was sitting, and she had like a thing behind her so that she couldn't like see that how high up she was, you know, and she had all these people around her that worked there, she felt safe, you know. Yeah. And that anytime it would sway, they were like, it's cool. Like, she had enough reassurance, as opposed to me standing there in line gaslighting her, because I don't know what else to do at that point in my life. You know, right. she had this safety of people. And it was like a beautiful moment of humanity to see, like, people are kind, you know, random strangers can be really,
there is good in the world,
you know. It was like beautiful. So that happened.
Yeah, that's one of the things. I mean, that's what I love about that, is that people rallied, and there is good in the world, and I see it all the time, all over the place. And when people say, "Ah, oh, everybody's just mean now," and I'm like, "Yeah, but weren't you just at the store and somebody let you go in front of them because you only had one item, and didn't you? You know, these little things happen, and we need to build those up and notice them."
Yeah. I do see it, and the more I look for it, the more I see it, you know?
I think that's the key.
Yeah, you will find what you are looking for. If you're looking for bad, you're going to find it. If you're looking for good, you're going to find it. You will find what you're looking for. Like, what's that that adage that's like, you'll find evidence to support any theory, you know?
Right.
Any theory you have, you'll find evidence to support, you know? So,
Malachi, do you have any questions that feel like we didn't cover?
No, we covered my the things I wanted to.
Great. Kate, is there anything we didn't get to that you would like to?
No, I just, if anybody is interested in reading Down the Rabbit Hole, A Memoir of Abuse, Addiction, and Recovery, or Voicemails from My Sister, Stories of a Schizoaffective Sibling, both are available on Amazon and on Audible. They're available on Kindle or in paperback, or again, an Audible. I do narrate them myself. I have
a personal touch.
So there you go. And I edited them myself, which was tedious, but I also wouldn't relinquish that control for anything. I had somebody offer to edit it for me, and I was like, no.
Well, but I mean
the audiobook, because I wanted to be in charge of the pace. I wanted to be in control of the pacing of it. The books were edited, like, by professionals, so don't go thinking they're like...
Somebody other than you read them before they were published?
Correct. Many people, good. So they've been edited, so yeah. And then I have a website, katerussellauthor.com, which I just redid. I hired a task rabbit to redo my website, which I highly recommend. He did a great job, so...
Nice. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, so I understand that about the editing, because I, but anyways, I do all the editing because I care about the content. And if I relinquish that, then the sound will be better, but the content might not be what I'm going for. And I'm not sure how to strike that balance yet, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
Okay. You did mention also that you are going to write two more books, and that you're working on one right now about your father.
Sure am.
So we're looking forward to that coming out.
No, boy.
Certainly are.
Any ETA on that? Or
no, it takes as long as it takes. I don't sit on things. Like, I'm not a procrastinator. So it'll get written, but I'm not going to give myself a deadline, because I don't feel like that is going to make the book any better, you know, but don't worry.
Beautiful.
It's coming. It took me a year to write voicemails, but we were in a pandemic and I didn't have a jobby job. So it might take a little longer than that, but I want it to be good.
Makes perfect
Definitely
sense.
Definitely take
yeah,
the
no
time it needs.
Yeah.
Well, it's been awesome having you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This was fun.
Thank you. It certainly was.
Yeah. And for people listening, if you have, first of all, if you're interested, absolutely go to katerussellauthor.com. So listeners, if you're interested, yes, go to katerussellauthor.com. and check it out. She has other podcast interviews on there too. And we are hoping to maybe do other interviews in the future. This is new and we're getting our footing, so we'll see. And hoping to have Kate back at some point, me being a trauma specialist and that being what absolutely I'm passionate about, I would love to ask more questions about down the rabbit hole. So Sure. Maybe we can do that at a later date.
I'm totally down. That's my baby.
Okay.
Sweet.
I'm sure.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's
absolutely been a pleasure.
Yes.
So, cool. Thank you all for listening so much. It was absolutely a pleasure to have Kate on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing the things that we had to discuss, and we'll consider picking up one of her books in one of the formats available. Next time, we'll be back to a more normal type of episode. I don't remember off the cuff what exactly episode will be coming next, so watch our social media. I'm sure we'll let you know about that.
I have to say, by normal, he means typical.
So yeah, check those links out, and we'll see you next time. Thank you all so much for listening, and we want to remind you to always be gentle with yourself. So important. Take care now, y'all. We'll see you next time.
Bye, guys.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of You're Not Crazy, Psychology in Real Life. We hope that you enjoyed it and maybe learned something along the way. Look for us on Instagram and Twitter at You're Not Crazy PC. We'd love to hear from you.
You're Not Crazy is produced for entertainment and educational purposes only and is not intended to be psychotherapy of any type. No discussion, commentary, words, or suggestions are meant to be construed as therapy, intervention, diagnosis, or as constituting a therapeutic relationship. If you feel unsafe, suicidal, homicidal, or in danger of harming yourself or others in any way, please seek therapeutic or crisis intervention through medical or mental health services in your area or call 911.